I may have had in mind then, as I wrote about the supine lady, this beautiful opium lady, who was a kind of figure like the white goddess, a source of dreams, images, symbolic love and power to all her friends, including Thornton Wilder, who was a frequent bedside caller. And I think of her as a kind of something more than human, like a goddess living in two worlds. When she died, we could scarcely mourn for her because she had always been so much a part of the other world. She was like someone who lived in heaven now, and I'm sure that I must have had in mind this beautiful lady. Now, I don't have with me a copy of Angel of the Forest, but there are themes and relationships to these poems in that book in one way, and in another way they come again in Miss McIntosh, My Darling. Miss McIntosh, My Darling is a bus journey. I was writing it when John Steinbeck's The Wayward Bus came out, and that I suppose might have intimidated many people. Oh, the bus journey has been done now, but at least I went ahead with my bus journey, a longer one than his, I'm afraid. This is a story of an archetypal poor little rich girl in flight from a New England fabulous household where her mother has been an opium addict. And she has been away from home for some time, but recalls the one sane, sensible person she ever knew in life, Miss McIntosh, her darling, a red-headed nursemaid from Watcher, Iowa, who has told her continually of the good life in the Middle West, where all people are middle-brow, of the middle way, sane, sensible, normal, average, down to earth, do not entertain phantoms and dreams. Certainly, Miss McIntosh, my darling, never would. She said if ever she met with the phantom Emperor Constantine in the fog along that New England seacoast, he is one of the opium lady's favorite phantoms, she would give him a whack with her black umbrella. She would certainly tell him what she thought of him, and ask him why he changed the calendar, because she believes that we're all off on the wrong day of the week, which we are. And the trouble with Miss McIntosh, as you will find out, I think, on page 6, is that she committed suicide. She's dead before the book starts. And the whole book, in a way, is an inquiry. Why did this sane, sensible woman commit suicide, and all these mad people live? Why do they flourish? Why do they even enjoy their madness? They have a marvelous time. They are more involved with Mark Twain than existentialism. In fact, they were written before Sartre came along with his pessimistic attitudes, and I could never accept them being a Mark Twain, a Middle Westerner. Just like Miss McIntosh, my darling, I suppose. Why did she die and the others live? There are many, many answers to this question, and you know when the book starts that the quest is doomed, that life is not going to be all that she said it would be in the Middle West. In fact, when she gets to this tiny town on the banks of the Wabash, it's the same town in which my utopia has occurred, but I have only one little clue for a careful reader. And I don't mention utopia anywhere else. Everyone there is more involved with whirlpool, illusion, maelstrom, nightmare, and dream than anything the opium lady could possibly have dreamed of. Because after all, if you take opium, you are protected from reality, and even from the ultimate consequences of dreams. But when you walk around in this world, then you really are exposed. So that when this young girl has finally lived through through all the possible ways of approaching the problem of reality and dream. When she has exhausted these, she is ready for her own adult life, and she marries. On the 20 pages, I believe it is, before the end of the book, she meets her true love. And my editor at Scribner's, Mr. Mitchell, says, "The thing about this book, Marguerite, is really a girl meets boy book." And he said, "I think it's marvelous the way you pull it off in the last 20 pages." So she meets her love and marries, and I'm sure lives happily ever after, as happily as one can live. She marries a man who is deaf, and there is a certain happiness in that fact. If you've ever known a deaf man, as I have, you know that they are the most, I think, most inclined to be very beautiful and often very happy people. Like my landlady in New York, she has earphones, she keeps them off. I finally got her to put them on one day. I said, "President Kennedy has been killed." She instantly turned them off. She said, "You see why I keep them off? She said, I don't want to hear the bad news." So she's just like the opium lady in that she wears hoop skirts and lives in a world of dreams. I didn't know this when I moved into the house. I found a character right there. You can't escape your characters either. Don't ever write about anything unless you want to meet with it shortly after. I wrote about a mad shoplifter coming to the opium lady's house, a big fat lady coming there, and two or three days later I met a big fat shoplifter coming into a great mansion, country mansion, where I was staying, walking in right straight into the front door. She said, it was a literary, the home of a literary person. She said, "Is James Farrell here?" It turned out that she hadn't seen him for 20 years, but she was looking for him with her big net bag. I don't know whether she caught him or not. Well, this novel has a great many comic aspects, although it's written seriously, and it is written as a poet writes. And all these images are supposed to be enjoyed at a sensual level, like painting and music, the beauty of the word. I don't care for the plain school of leaving all those images out. I've had a few writers tell me that they leave them in the wastebasket. And I always say, I don't tell them this, of course. And they're now in New York, and I'm sure they're not going to hear that. I would rather read what they left in the wastebasket than the plain cat chase dog or dog chase cat school of prose. That doesn't interest me at all. I've always said, I thought they should be bricklayers, except for one thing. I wouldn't want to live in the houses they build, because the bricks would soon fall on your head, because they don't lay their bricks very well either. Well, I suppose I might read just a paragraph or two from the opening scene as to the opium lady herself. Now, someone might say, "Oh, you have a marvelous imagination." But I can assure you that the opium lady I knew was exactly like this, even to the pearls that she used to count. And she had an imaginary chauffeur named James. She used to say, "Home, James," every once in a while. "Home, James." And I never forget one time I was talking to Truman Capote, who was had read this. And he was in the hospital, and he said that he was just coming out from the ether, and he heard this lady say, "Oh, James, isn't that Henry James walking along the street there? Oh, how do you do, Mr. James? Aren't you coming to tea?" And so forth. And he said, "Where am I?" He started screaming, "Nurse, nurse, get me out of here. get me out of here. He said, who is that? It was Mrs. Astor, Mrs. Astor was dying, and she thought she was out riding in Newport, bowing to Henry James and other friends. And Truman said, I can't afford to be in this wing. Get me into the poor man's ward. So these things happen every day if you're a close observer, you see. They really do. Home James. You know, I never forget the time I heard it in reality and there was actually a James there. That was more shocking to me than old ladies imagining they're going out riding when they're not. Well, I'm not going to be able to get to James in this, but that will be something to inspire you all to go by Miss McIntosh and find out about James. Let's see. I'll just read a paragraph. You know, I really rather not read it all, except that I'm confronted with an educated audience. And they're all used to hearing reading. My mother was oblivious to the realities of flesh and blood, those creatures of chance, apparently even to Miss McIntosh, loud-mouthed though she was, unimaginative. No possible rival in the world of invisible dreams, the prosaic, fusty, busty old nursemaid with reddening cheeks, her red marcelled hair gleaming like the sand streaked with sunset when the sandpipers wade in the glassy surf as the last light fades, her footsteps always certain, the last person who would ever disappear, the moral guide to the pale, rejected child whose eyes had not craved reality. My mother trusted no one, nor was she ever to be surprised, it seemed, by unusual transformations or transports, shiftings of form, by anything that might ever transpire. By anything protean, for the opium dreams surrounding her had provided no pillar of strength, no rose which did not eventually fade, no voice which did not fail. She presumed always that things were not what they seemed, that all forms must change their shapes, that all characters must bear, even to those most familiar with them, an element of cold surprise, even of horror, that her life was this play of illusion, that there should be nothing certain but uncertainty, no pavement more secure than the glassy surface of the evening tide and the far wash of waves. All her days were her nights, and all her nights were her days, and there was an eternal twilight, an obfuscation of faces, a crucial bewilderment. If servants were known as she was known, would not their lives appear more monstrous than hers and terribly extra-human? So she would ask, talking half in her enchanted sleep, often when there was no one present, but the dream of who was not. Heavily laden with jewels as a Greek corpse, my mother, she who had retired from the brutal world, whose eyes were shielded against the vulgar sunlight, slept for tideless years, which were her vast excitement, surrounding herself with a world of dreams, visions, phantoms. Her bedroom is filled with visitors as the Grand Central Station, some from the shores of Hades, voices of the dead, faded movie stars as the silent flicker films, imaginary telephone operators plugging in at imaginary switchboards, spirits like long-nosed bird dogs, drowned pearl divers, old kings, old queens, figures older than Oedipus or Troy, New England spinsters with faces checkered like chessboards, jockeys riding the skeletons of dead horses, angelic birds. Her sleep was a form of watchful, wide-eyed wakefulness. Her wakefulness was a form of sleep. Nothing would have amazed her so much as nothing, the complete deprivation, the absence of being, for that was something too, and always present in her eyes, as familiar to her as human frailty. She hovered for years between life and suspended death, enjoying both, her eyes refulgently shining, her eyes opened at times when she profoundly slept, one cheek always toward the shadow, her dark hair arranged in such a way that this cheek was always concealed. It was because of this shadowed cheek that she had gone to bed in the first place so many years ago, because of a blemish, a stain, a birthmark which was invisible to others, and which, besides, was always covered with fine white rice powder, shadowed even then, she's standing only where the shadow fell. Now that she was always apparently in the bloom of some strange extension of health, though she was yet the eternal invalid, the horizontal person, one whose heart, as she believed, was not centralized, but scattered through every nerve cell, shining like sourceless starlight. Lying still in a sumptuous bed, carved with faceless dolphins and cherubim and kingly faces and heraldic devices, a box of sweets always within her reach, numberless pearls running through her ivory-colored fingers, a white satin coverlet covering her to the waist, her shoulders swathed in gauze and velvet, and delicate cascades of ancient lace, she believed that she had died in her youth and was yet alive, that there were two selves, the dead, the living, that though she lay still, this beautiful corpse or effigy upon a marble sarcophagus, this was the living being, this was the bright, luminous eyes, the distracting visions, the endless stream of imaginary company, of fawns crowned with flowers, men who were birds, women whose heads were turrets, that the one who was dead was walking, walking by the sea, or riding a white horse through endless surf.